Hi folks, this is just a short message to let you know that I'll be playing ads on this podcast from now on. In 2020, I realised I was spending more time working on the podcast than I was in my full-time job. And the addition of advertising means that I'll be able to devote more time to researching, writing and recording episodes. If you would prefer an ad-free version of the podcast, you can get that over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Over there, I'll also be posting videos and media related to The Troubles. If you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or by simply telling your friends. It all helps. Thanks, and let's get into it. It was around 7 in the evening in the Divis flats when there was a knock on the door of the McConvilles. The children answered the door to a number of individuals. They asked, "Where is Jean?" And when she appeared, they told her to put on a coat and they took her out into the night. They told the children that she'd be back in 30 minutes. That was the last time Jean McConville was ever seen alive. In the days following her abduction, no neighbours called over to check on the children and no investigation was ever opened up. Jean simply vanished and no one, except her children, wanted to know where she went. This is The Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. During the Troubles, there was a small group of 16 people who became known as the Disappeared. Most of these people were taken from their homes and never seen again. They simply vanished without a trace. In most cases, these people were taken by paramilitary groups, and there was a distinct reason for them being taken. That could be related to an internal dispute, but more likely the person was accused of being an informer or a tout, and providing intel to the enemy. This was the most serious of crimes in the eyes of the paramilitary groups. So why weren't they murdered and publicly dumped like the hundreds of others that were killed in such a way? There are a few reasons, but making someone disappear is a way to avoid culpability. In the case of the IRA, even though all the signs may point at them for the kidnap and murder of an individual, if there is no body to be found, the IRA can continue to deny having anything to do with it. This denial was very useful when they were afraid of a public backlash. As I've said before, PR was very important to paramilitary groups. On a personal perspective, when you lose a loved one, there is something cathartic about the wake and the funeral, and you're allowed the appropriate amount of time to grieve and say goodbye to that person. None of this happens when a person disappears. There's no body, and there's no funeral. As of writing, decades after these people were taken, some of the bodies have been discovered, but some remain lost in time, buried deep in a place, as the few remaining people who still know the location start to die off, or the geographical landscape changes so much that it makes it impossible for the bodies to be found. Though the number of people who disappeared is relatively small, each one caused shockwaves that have lasted years, and none so much as Jean McConville. Jean Murray was born in 1934 to a Protestant family in East Belfast. Her father worked in the Harland and Wolff shipyards, and Jean began looking for work at the age of 14. She eventually found a job working as a servant for a Catholic widow, Mary McConville. Mary had a son called Arthur, who was a Catholic man who had worked as a soldier in the British Army. He was 12 years older than Jean, and the two fell in love and decided to elope. As this was the 1950s, yes, it was unusual for a Catholic man to marry a Protestant, but it wasn't as controversial as it would soon become, once the Troubles ignited. Arthur's mother was not pleased with the marriage, more so for the crossing of the domestic line rather than the religious one. The two married in 1952 and lived in an army barracks in England, where Arthur was stationed. Jean took the name McConville and also converted from Protestant to Catholic for Arthur. They moved back to Belfast in 1957. Jean went on to have 14 children, four of which would end up dying not long after childbirth. The 10 surviving children were Anne, Robert, Helen, Agnes, Archie, Michael, Tucker, Susan, Billy and Jim. Arthur retired from the army in 1964 and set about looking for work in Northern Ireland. But he had trouble finding work, and in one case he ended up losing his job once his employers discovered that he was a Catholic. The McConvilles lived in the Protestant part of East Belfast, but life there became very difficult as the 60s progressed. This was around the time where Ian Paisley was making inflammatory speeches and ordering Protestants to expel Catholic families from their neighbourhoods. In his speeches, he would list the addresses of known Catholics, and then people would stand outside and intimidate the occupants. Arthur was the first to be told to leave the area because he was a Catholic. Then Jean and the children were forced out 4 weeks later, packing all their belongings into a taxi and leaving. These people would have considered Jean a traitor for converting from Protestant to Catholic. Because of these factors, Jean and Arthur had a hard time being welcomed in any community. They first moved in with Arthur's mother, but she only had one bedroom, and it simply wasn't enough for the McConville family. Over the next few months, the family lived in temporary accommodation in a Catholic school, then were offered accommodation by the Belfast Housing Authority a number of times. Each time they went to move in, they encountered a family of squatters who'd also been displaced as a result of the Troubles and refused to leave. Finally, when Arthur was offered a chalet on Divis Street, he was so determined to get in that he stayed there every single day with the builders until it was finished, to ensure his family got the apartment. They stayed there until 1970, when they were offered permanent accommodation in the newly built Divis Flats. Divis Flats were built as part of a slum clearance plan. The old 19th century dwellings were raised and then were replaced with 12 interconnected housing blocks, which had 850 units. There was a hope that this would alleviate the poverty that was going on in the area at the time. For many, this was the first time they would have an indoor toilet, shower, and a hot water sink. Divis was meant to be a utopian city in the sky. Though the flats were definitely an improvement for the life at the time, they were cheaply built, with paper-thin walls and an exterior which soon became covered in black mould. There was also little to no social space for the 1,000 children who lived there. For the McConvilles, it was a welcome relief to finally have their own place. The Divis flats were almost entirely Catholic, and as the Troubles kicked off and the death toll began to rapidly rise, the flats became a stronghold for armed resistance. By this stage, the British Army had arrived to Northern Ireland and had soon become universally hated by the Catholic population. There was a British Army post at the top two floors of one of the flats, which during the height of the Troubles was only accessible via helicopter. At night, gunshots would ring out throughout the city, which was shrouded in darkness because the streetlights had been shot out to prevent snipers from stealthily shooting at the British soldiers. The army would frequently raid people living in the Divis apartments, so the people there had devised a plan to hide any weapons from the soldiers, which became known as the chain. If a gun needed moving from an apartment, the residents would lean out the back window and pass it on to the next resident, who would then pass it on to the next person, until it was on the other side of the building. There were also frequent gun battles, and there were many, many nights where the McConvilles would have to drag their mattresses to the floor in the centre of the flat and sleep there, to minimise the risk of any stray bullets hitting them. Thousands of families found themselves in the middle of a war between the British Army and the IRA, and children would play in the rubble of buildings and burnt out cars like it was the most normal thing in the world. Patrick Radden Keefe writes in his book, Say Nothing, of the life of Michael McConville, who was one of Jean's children. He spent his boyhood living in this war zone. Michael would spend his days exploring derelict buildings and looking for pigeons that he could take home and raise. In one instance, he had climbed up into an old mill which had been blown out by a bomb, when he came across a company of British soldiers who were covertly hiding there. They shouted, "Halt or we'll fire," before Michael hastily made his exit. Since the escalation of things around Divis Flats, Jean's husband, Arthur, had been growing weaker and weaker. He eventually went to the doctor who diagnosed him with lung cancer, which took hold rapidly. Arthur passed away in 1972, leaving Jean widowed with 10 children, aged between 6 and 20. After the death of Arthur, Jean fell into a deep depression, eventually suffering a nervous breakdown. Some have described this as a form of post-traumatic stress disorder that a lot of civilians were experiencing at the time. It's also been referred to as Belfast syndrome. Jean rarely left the house during this time, only for groceries and to visit her eldest son Robert, who was in prison at the time, detained in Longkesh for membership of the official IRA. The provisional IRA at this time were exerting strict rules on the civilian population. If any Catholic girls were discovered to have been with a British soldier, they were literally tarred and feathered, with their heads shaved. People were afraid to even make eye contact with the British soldiers, for fear that somebody would report them. There was a heavy sense of paranoia in the air. According to Jean's children, she first became known to the IRA in the aftermath of a gun battle which was happening just outside their flat. Her children say that there was a shooting, then silence, and then a voice outside the door saying, quote, "Help me, please God, I don't want to die." Jean peeked out her door and saw an injured British soldier lying on the ground. She went back into her flat and got a cushion and brought it to the soldier, comforting him. She then said a prayer while cradling his head before creeping back into the flat. As soon as she came back inside, her son Archie said to her, "You're only asking for trouble." Jean replied saying, quote, "That was somebody's son." They didn't see the soldier again after that night. This story has also been disputed, as there is no record of British soldiers being in that flat around this time frame. Because she was a Protestant, Jean had already been unpopular amongst the extremely tight-knit community that lived in Divis Flats, and this unpopularity gradually grew worse as time went on. Jean didn't want to lose another son to prison, so as a result she refused to take part in the chain which I mentioned earlier. Some of her children were attacked by other children for refusing to join the IRA, and her daughter, Helen, was harassed by British soldiers. Then one day, the two McConville dogs, who were named Provo and Sticky, disappeared, only to be discovered stuffed down a trash chute where they died. The entire family were considered untouchable, and as a result of Jean's actions with the British soldier, now the IRA were watching her as well. It's hard to pinpoint the date for what follows, but there was also an incident in which Jean was at the local bingo hall when she was called out after someone told her that one of her children was injured and a car was there to bring her to the hospital. This was all a trap, and Jean was actually taken away by the IRA and interrogated. She was then found wandering the streets of Belfast in the early hours of the morning after being beaten. Agnes McConville remembers her mother returning that night. Quote, "There was a lot of blood on her. Her face was swollen and everything. Black and blue, and all she could say was when we got her settled. We got her a cup of tea and gave her cigarettes. She must have smoked the cigarettes one after another and drank tea, and she started to get sick. So she did, with her nerves." It's unclear exactly when Jean was taken. One McConville child says that the following events happened one night after the bingo hall attack, which police reports say happened on the 29th of November 1972. Other sources say it happened on December 7th. Either way, it was 7 p.m. in the evening and Jean had just gotten out of the bath. She had sent her daughter Helen out to get fish and chips for dinner. As Helen was on her way back, she saw something strange. A group of people loitering outside her apartment. Fearing that something was wrong, she broke into a run. Meanwhile, back at the McConville flat, there was a knock on the door before a large group of people barged their way in. Some were wearing balaclavas, some were without them, and they were shouting, "Where is she?" Jean emerged and they told her to come with them. Jean began to scream, shouting, "Help me, help me," surrounded by her children. Michael recalls recognizing two of the kidnappers were two young girls who used to be their neighbours. The group ordered Jean outside and her eldest son Archie went with her until they pointed a gun at his head and ordered him to leave. They then told the children that she would be back in half an hour. Jean was placed in the back of a van and was never seen again. Agnes remembers her mother wearing red shoes and a tweedy coat on the day she disappeared. She used to always have a safety pin somewhere on her coat, as there was always a baby that needed changing, and she would use the safety pin to fasten the child's nappy. Michael remembers that around 5 days later, an IRA man came to the door and gave him Jean's purse and her wedding rings. He asked about his mother, to which the man replied, "Look, I was just told to give these rings to you. I know nothing about it." Michael, who was 11 at the time, says he then received a direct threat from the IRA, saying, quote, "Say nothing, or else." In the days following Jean's abduction, there was radio silence. No neighbours came by, no police. The children were left to fend for themselves. In all likelihood, everyone in the flats knew their mother had been taken, but people wanted nothing to do with it, and some believed that Jean got what she deserved for helping that soldier, and for other reasons, which I'll get into later. Some of the children ended up shoplifting food for the family, and Christmas came and went for the McConville children without any news of their mother. Then on the 16th of January, the children were featured on the front page of the Belfast Telegraph with the title, Snatched Mother Missing a Month. This prompted a visit from the BBC, who captured a short interview with the children, which I'll play now.
Well, Mummy was over at my granny's. She just came over and three young girls came in and they all just only come in the kitchen and came in. They ordered all the kids up to the up the stairs. And now they just walked in and took my mummy. Mummy says Mummy walked out the hall, put on her coat and her.
What did your mummy say when she left?
Mummy had a big squeal out of it. And then so they asked my brother. They says my brother could go out with her. And they chased my brother back up again, and that's all I know.
Mm. Do you know why your mummy went away? Do you know why she was taken away?
No. She's never done anything, she's never.
She's never done anything?
No, she was always in the house next to just went to Bengal.
Helen, I believe you're looking after the family. How are you managing to cope?
Okay.
How are you getting money, for example?
We draw my mummy's last pension.
Mm-hmm. Does that manage to feed all the family? Because you've got a large family.
Yeah.
You manage to get by. When do you think you'll see your mummy again?
Tomorrow.
Nobody's been in touch with you at all, Agnes?
No.
Nobody at all.
A news story like this was considered very sensational by the media at the time, and the story could have been dragged out for weeks. But Republicans decided to spread the word that Jean had gone into hiding instead, and that she may arrive home at any minute. This ploy worked, and the story died down quite quickly. The McConville children heard things differently from other children in Divis Flats, and there were rumours spreading around that Jean had run off with a British soldier, which further upset them. A social worker also visited the children and recommended putting them into the care of the state, which the children refused at first, but soon were left with no other options. In February, three women showed up to their apartment, saying that they had been granted tenancy, which forced the McConville children out. By this stage, the eldest child, Anne, had constant health issues and was in hospital. Robert was interned, Archie was old enough to work for himself, and Agnes was looking after Granny McConville, who was blind. Helen was in the middle. She was too old to be put into care and too young to be independent, so she bounced around her siblings and slept on couches. The remaining five children became wards of the state and were brought to an orphanage which was called Nazareth Lodge and was run by nuns. One description of this place that I came across was a bleak, pinched place where beatings and harsh punishment were routine. Michael frequently escaped from Nazareth, and he and his brother, Tucker, were eventually moved out of the city of Belfast entirely to the De La Celle boys' home in the county of Down, which was run by the Christian Brothers. For Michael, being out in the countryside was completely new to him, after growing up surrounded by the city streets, and it could have been a great part of his life. Unfortunately, De La Celle Boys' Home was one of the many, many industrial homes in Ireland and Northern Ireland, where children faced a litany of physical and sexual abuse. Michael and his brother were beaten daily by the older boys in the school, and Michael says that he was never sexually abused, but he remembers seeing priests taking boys out of his dorm in the middle of the night. The two younger McConville children, twins Billy and Jim, were also assigned to De La Celle. At seven, they were the youngest boys in the home, and as well as being physically assaulted by the older boys, Billy was also sexually assaulted by the adults, later saying of the priests there, quote, "Christians looking after young boys. Maybe they were Christians, but to me they were devils disguised in that uniform." Michael continued with his escape attempts and was soon moved again to a secure residential facility for boys, which in reality was more of a juvenile detention facility than anything. This place ended up giving Michael space to heal and escape the troubles and his past. When he turned 16, he was released back into the world. Adulthood for the McConvilles was difficult, and there were issues with drugs, alcohol, and homelessness. The eldest, Anne, eventually passed away in 1992 at the age of 39. Some of them continued to try and find out what happened to their mother. There was a point at which Helen had the opportunity to emigrate to Australia, but she decided to stay in Northern Ireland, because a part of her still believed that her mother could come home one day. There were also a number of instances where the adult McConville children would be going about their daily life and accidentally bump into some of the people who'd been involved in the taking of their mother on that fateful night. Like I said earlier, not all of the abductors were wearing masks, and some were recognisable. In one instance, Michael got into the taxi, and the taxi driver was one of the men who took his mother. Another time, Helen went into a McDonald's and bumped into one of the women who'd been there that night. Years turned into decades with virtually no news of what happened to their mother. Shortly after the Good Friday Agreement was signed and the violence had ended, the McConville children banded together with other people whose family members were forcibly disappeared. Gerry Adams was the leader of Sinn Féin at the time, who were considered the political wing of the IRA, and families continued to increase the pressure they were putting on him and Sinn Féin to respond. By 1995, the pressure continued to increase, so much so that US President Bill Clinton appealed to him and Sinn Féin for information. Eventually, Adams issued a statement saying, quote, "I call upon anyone who has information about the whereabouts of these missing people to contact the families." He also visited some of the McConville children and apologised on behalf of whoever took their mother, saying in one instance to Michael, quote, "For what it's worth, I apologise for what the Republican movement did to your mother." It's important to stop here and remember that Gerry Adams has always denied being a member of the IRA. In 1998, a representative from the IRA had admitted to Helen that they had been responsible for disappearing Jean, claiming that Jean was an informant, or a tout. In 1999, legislation was passed to try and help find some of the bodies of the disappeared. It said that anyone who provided information that would eventually lead to the discovery of the bodies would receive limited immunity from prosecution. This led to information being received as to the whereabouts of Jean's body. Thus, a search began on a beach in the Irish county of Louth, just across the border into the Republic of Ireland. The McConville children, now in their 30s and 40s, gathered as the excavators spent 50 days digging up the beach looking for Jean's body. Eventually, with no success, the search was called off. Then, in 2003, a man was walking along the beach with his dog, not far from the original site that had been searched, when he came across a piece of fabric in the sand. He had a closer look and soon discovered bones underneath. He had found a body. The coroner report said that it was a body of a woman and it had been in the sand for an advanced length of time. There was also a single gunshot to the back of the skull, which would have been the cause of death. The McConvilles came together again and were brought into a room where the remains of bones and surviving articles of clothing were laid out on a table for them to identify. There were tights, underwear, the remains of a skirt, and parts of a shoe. Archie then asked, "Is there a nappy pin?" remembering how his mother used to always have a spare safety pin pinned to her clothes. After looking again, there it was, pinned to a corner of the fabric. Jean McConville had been found, 31 years after she was taken. Because her body was found by a member of the public and not as a result of the information provided by the IRA, this meant that the case was still open and the killers could still be prosecuted. But how much could be found out 31 years after this crime has occurred? In the case of Jean McConville, a lot. But let's go back to the abduction itself. Within 2 days of Jean's kidnap, one of her sons reported her missing to the RUC, but nothing ever came of it. An investigation was never opened. It was 1972 in Northern Ireland, which was the worst year of the Troubles in terms of death toll, and the RUC would have had a very difficult time operating in the Divis Flats, where they were universally despised. They said that investigations at that time were, quote, restricted to the most serious cases. There were rumours on the street, but over the years, any efforts from the McConvilles to find out who killed their mother revealed nothing. The IRA did eventually release a statement in 2006 saying, quote, "Following a public request from the family of Jean McConville, the IRA carried out a thorough investigation into all the circumstances surrounding her death. That investigation confirmed that Jean McConville was working as an informer for the British Army. The conclusion of this investigation was reported to Michael McConville. The IRA accepts, he rejects this conclusion. The IRA regrets the suffering of all families whose loved ones were killed and buried by the IRA. To be honest, this IRA statement did not offer much. The truth would eventually come out though, thanks in part to the Boston College tapes. They probably deserve their own episode, but the Boston College tapes are secret recordings in which ex-paramilitaries talked about their role during the Troubles. During the Troubles, secrecy was paramount. And many of the incidents, bombings, and murders that occurred are still shrouded in secrecy and mystery today. The Boston College tapes were an attempt to preserve history for future generations by taking recordings in secret and sealing them off for years, only to be released after the death of the interviewee. The ex-paramilitaries could give their own private interviews, confident they wouldn't be released until after their own death. Some of the people interviewed believed that this was more of a time capsule, and that the recordings would be released long after the deaths of all the people involved. This is an important point. In theory, this was a great idea. But there was one concerning question raised. If a dead person accused a living person of a crime, could these tapes be used as evidence to prosecute the living person? Brendan Hughes was the former officer commander of the Belfast Brigade of the IRA. In later life, he became disillusioned with the IRA and Sinn Féin. He was one of the people who took part in the Boston College tapes, recording hours of interviews and talking about the acts he was involved in. It was here he mentioned his regret at the organisation of the Bloody Friday bombings, which I mentioned in a previous episode. After his death, Hughes' interviews were adapted into a book called Voices from the Grave, which was published in 2010. For the first time, a detailed account revealed what happened to Jean, according to Hughes. Be aware, this account is according to Hughes and it has been disputed. In his interview, Hughes said that the Divis Flats had been a major source of recruitment and activity by the IRA, and that Jean had been passing information on to British soldiers. The IRA had been informed that Jean had a British Army radio transmitter in her apartment. Hughes said that they searched her apartment and discovered it, and she was taken away to be interrogated, where she admitted that she was working for the British Army. She was given a chance because she was a woman and warned not to do so again. Shortly afterwards, they discovered another transmitter in her apartment, and this time Hughes said that she was taken away to be executed. He said, quote, "I mean, she deserved to be executed. She was an informer and put other people's lives at risk." When it comes to who ordered the execution, Hughes went on to say, quote, "There was only one man who gave that order for that woman to be executed, and that man is now the head of Sinn Féin." He was talking about Gerry Adams. As well as Adams, the tapes also implicated Ivor Bell and Pat McClure. We'll come back to this later, but it's now I should bring up Dolores Price. She was another hardline Republican, who, alongside her sister Marion, were involved in a number of operations during the Troubles. I'll be doing an episode about her eventually. Price was a member of a secret unit of the Provisional IRA who were known as the Unknowns. They were the IRA's special intelligence unit. They dealt with internal issues in the IRA, and specifically informers or touts. They were a group of young people totally devoted to the cause of the IRA, and who, quote, "could be trusted with very specific jobs, obeying orders without question." In later years, Dolores went the same way as Brendan Hughes, and grew increasingly disillusioned with the IRA and Sinn Féin, and she began to speak out about her role during the Troubles. Dolores also took part in the Boston College tapes, but said nothing about Jean McConville. In 2010, Dolores gave a video interview to the Irish journalist Ed Maloney. Her stipulation was that the interview would only be released after her death. Dolores died in 2013, at the age of 62, and this video interview became the basis for the documentary I, Dolores, which was released in 2018. It's half documentary, half reenactment, and in it Dolores explains her role in the disappearance of Jean McConville. Most of the following account comes from Dolores herself, and again, it's important to remember that some people have disagreed with this account. Dolores explained, quote, "Jean McConville was identified as an informer. Her house, her flat in Divis Flats, had been discovered, had a transmitter, where she was supposedly passing information over to the British Army." End quote. This part matches Hughes' account, but Dolores went on to explain another reason that McConville was taken. Quote, she was also observed by some volunteers who were taken into Hastings Street Barracks to be identified by a person concealed behind a blanket. She was concealed behind a blanket with a slit in it that she could see through, and the blanket stopped short of her feet, and some of the volunteers who went through the identification process recognised the slippers. End quote. Dolores is basically saying that Jean McConville had apparently been identifying suspected IRA members who were brought in front of her, and to protect her identity, they had a sheet draped over her, but she was recognised because of her slippers. Again, this story has never been proven, and the British Army would be extremely reluctant to reveal any information regarding informers. Dolores explained that on the night in question, Jean McConville was abducted by Cumann na Mban, which was the name given to the women's wing of the IRA. They questioned her, and Dolores said that Jean admitted that she had been working with the British Army in exchange for money. For this, the IRA had sentenced her to death. Dolores goes on to say that her and two other IRA members took Jean in the car across the border into the Republic of Ireland. To calm her down, they told her that she was being taken away somewhere safe by the charitable organisation, the Legion of Mary, and that her children would be brought to her at a later date. According to Dolores, Jean then said while being driven away, quote, I knew those Provo bastards wouldn't have the balls to shoot me. Dolores then said, the Provo bastards who were driving her thought, oh, wouldn't they? Which was unfortunate for her. She talked too much. Jean was left in Dundalk with the Dundalk unit of the IRA for a number of days, but they didn't want to kill her because she was a woman, so Dolores and two of her team members had to return to carry out the killing. They brought Jean out to the beach where the Dundalk members had already dug a grave. Dolores then explained what happened next. Quote, she was taken by the three volunteers to the grave and shot in the back of the head by one of the volunteers, and then the other two volunteers each fired a shot so that no one would say that they for certain had been the person to kill her. She was left in the grave and the local unit buried her. So there are two accounts of what happened to Jean from two IRA members who have passed away. What about the police force in Northern Ireland? In 2006, the police ombudsman for Northern Ireland, Nuala O'Loane, published a report about the police investigation into the killing. The report said that they found no evidence that Jean was an informer, but also that it was hard to really know, as the British government had a long-standing policy against revealing who had covertly worked with them. The Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, has since apologised for failing to investigate her disappearance. Though they failed to investigate her disappearance in 1972, they since have been more aggressive in trying to find the killers. For that reason, they were extremely interested in the Boston College tapes. These recordings were locked away in Boston College, but the PSNI believed that the tapes could provide essential information regarding Jean McConville's killers. They launched a legal bid to get possession of the tapes in 2011 and eventually got their hands on Hughes and Price's transcripts of their interviews. Then, in 2014, they arrested two people in connection to the tapes, Ivor Bell and Gerry Adams. Gerry Adams was the leader of the political party Sinn Féin at the time. This was quite big news when he was arrested. He was released without charge after 4 days, and in 2015 it was announced that he would not be charged due to insufficient evidence. He has continually claimed that he has had nothing to do with Jean McConville's disappearance, most recently saying in October 2019, quote, I categorically deny any involvement in the abduction, killing and burial of Jean McConville, or indeed any others. Ivor Bell did eventually face charges in 2016 as a result of the claims it is alleged that his voice made on the Boston tapes. His trial was initially postponed as his legal team claimed that he was suffering from dementia and he was unfit to stand trial. He did eventually stand trial in 2019 but was cleared of involvement in the murder of Jean McConville after the Boston tapes were ruled unreliable. As of writing in 2021, it's 49 years since Jean's disappearance. Three of the McConville children have since passed away, Agnes, Billy and Anne. The remaining McConvilles are still campaigning for an inquest into their mother's death and are firmly convinced that Jean was not an informant. As of October 2020, it has been reported that they intend to launch a civil action against Sinn Féin and Gerry Adams. Civil action cases require a lower burden of proof than criminal action cases. The killing of Jean McConville has become a focal point in the Troubles for a myriad of reasons. Partly because the accusations go straight to the leadership of Sinn Féin, and also because of the sheer violence of the killing, to kill a widowed mother and leave her children orphaned. As a result of the accusations of being an informant, there has been a muted response that has existed for the past 49 years. Jean finally had a funeral in 2003, but there was a noticeable emptiness in the church that some people found surprising. Because she had been coloured as an informant, the stain would follow the children around for the rest of their lives. During my research, I came across a recent video that a teenager took at Jean's grave and posted to social media. The comments, which were all young people, were filled with people saying she got what she deserved. That mentality still exists today. We still don't know for certain who it was that killed Jean McConville. Patrick Radden-Keefe writes in his book that Dolores Price was present, as well as Pat McClure, and an unnamed third person. It is believed that it was the third person who pulled the trigger, ending Jean's life. Whether that person will be publicly named and prosecuted, only time will tell. That's it for me. This was a very convoluted episode to write about, but I hope I've explained things as clearly as possible. To finish, I'll leave the last word to Michael McConville. Quote, "The IRA dehumanized every one of us. All the people that were taken away and secretly buried. They dehumanized every one of them, making out their lives were worthless. They did that all the time on our mother."